from the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking spokes puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare, the hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in store or at mybobs.com to play now.
For those in recovery, support from friends and family often leads to better outcomes. Here's to those who are essential to helping people find their path to recovery. Visit cdc.gov/stopoverdose for information about treatment options and how to support those experiencing addiction.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
Sports Radio 610 presents Seth Payne and Sean Pendergast.
We coming to H time. Let's get the work in, man. Let's go.
Great day, great day. Oh, give me some juice, baby.
Oh, yeah.
To left field, Dubon is there. And the Astros win it. 6-3. Houston taking the first of this four-game series. Took a 4-run eighth inning. It wasn't the cleanest game, but it's one that goes in the win column, and the Astros will certainly take it.
It was not the cleanest game, as Kevin Eschenfelder said on the Space City Home Network, but they did, in fact, take the win. It was a roller coaster ride. Astros looked like they were going to win, then they looked like they were going to lose, and then they won it again, and then Josh Hader was out there, and he's been pretty good, but I'm like, how's this going to go? But they pulled it off, Seth. Brandon Scott in for Sean Pendergast here with Seth Payne on Payne and Pendergast this morning, and more good news. I don't know if you heard, Seth.
Yes.
But there's more good news. The Astros, they win, as you just heard. The first of four against the Kansas City Royals, extending their lead in the AL West. And this looks like a legitimate baseball team, Seth. That's where I want to start. Like, this looks like a playoff team. Joe Espada looks like a postseason manager, the way he's pushing the right buttons. And I do have to give him a lot of credit. We'll hear from him later on in the show. But, Seth, this was good. This was good news yesterday.
It was really cool. I'll tell you what, Espada using three pinch runners in that game, and I look, DiCenzo with about as an exciting walk as you can get with the bases loaded. It was a 1-2 count, and he sat on three sliders to advance the runners. It was really, really cool, and it was in a night too where, you know, Pena mishandles a ball.
Yeah.
You had Whitcomb not with an error, but a play that Bregman probably would have made after Bregman gets ejected early in the game on a strange ejection.
And then that's back to back games, by the way, where you could say Whitcomb with a not making a play that Bregman would have made.
Right. Yeah. So it was. You got to hand it to Espada for coming in under such ridiculously hard circumstances at the beginning of the year, and with us as a fan base not quite knowing whether to blame him or not, and that we all chose different routes and whether we would or not. But like, regardless, I think he's done a masterful job with the blessed and long forgotten small ball, man. He just, with guys that, you know, a lot of guys that shouldn't be up in the majors yet and that are, and he's getting the most out of them, or at least as much as you could hope to expect. And that was a fun one last night versus, as you reminded everybody yesterday, if you're not paying a bunch of attention to the league, the Royals are a good team. they've got, and then Witt, boy. Pena, okay, so I mentioned Pena's bobble at shortstop, of which he's just got way more this season than you ever would have expected. But Pena on that hit was, he's just so fast down the line. You know, like, he just,
One of their few guys with speed. Like, this is not a speed demon type of team. He's one of the few guys that threatened in that way.
Other than, like, the young guys that you can't necessarily trust as hitters, but at least, boy, you can get out there. And, you know, DiCenzo's hardly ever been used as a pinch hitter in his career in the amateurs or minors because he's such a good hitter. So you got a lot of guys in different roles. That was a fun, sometimes sloppy, depending on what point in the game you were. It was a frustrating yet fun one. My favorite part was Yiner taking out a full 2/9 of the guy on the field with one hit. Hits the pitcher with a line drive.
Yep.
Then the pitcher throws to first base, and Yiner, with no dirtiness or intent whatsoever, but does hit the first baseman's hand on his way to first. It was cool.
Yeah,
it was really, really cool. I think you were listening on the radio at that point, weren't you?
Yeah, no, they took out, or Yiner took out two players in one play.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean,
that's... It was two birds with one stone. It was everything you could hope for when trying to injure the opponent. Not trying to, but, you know, by happenstance, injuring the opponent.
Yeah, about as close to literal for that euphemism as you possibly could. Or, you know, two birds with one stone. Like, as close as you could get to literally killing two birds with one stone, knocking out two guys in one play. And, yeah, Seth, you're right. I missed a lot of this game because I was at the Texans premiere, or the Texans season premiere last night at NRG Stadium. And so when I got in my car, and I didn't even turn on the radio. I turned on the TV broadcast and just, like, propped the phone up in the car on the ride home so I could see the end of this game. And by the time I got in my car, it was 2-0 Astros. It's in the seventh with Brian Abreu on the mound. I'm like, hey, I figured I didn't miss much, and there's not much to see here. You know, like 2-0 Astros, they're handling business. They're going to handle business. And boy, was I wrong, man. That's basically like when the game starts, you know. You get that bases clearing 3-run double from the Royals that's like giving them the lead and making you think, oh, my God, the Astros are going to squander this one. And it's like, oh, okay, well, no sweat, 4 runs in the eighth. Some of the impressive at bat that you mentioned from DiCenzo to walk in the go ahead run, like there were just and of course that Yiner moment that's very peculiar where you take out two players with one play. There were a lot of moments in this game, even at the end of it, Seth. I missed most of this game, and I feel like caught the crux of it. Right,
you
like
saw you saw the important stuff. It was a highlight reel. The highlight / low light. There were some low lights in there if you don't win this game. But for a game that was kind of deadlocked for a long time, it just bust wide open at the end.
Yeah, for sure. So like I was really, really like basically all I missed. I was really impressed with this. All I missed was Hunter Brown being pretty solid again. Like I can only go by his line because obviously I wasn't watching while he was pitching. But based off of his line and the way things looked by the time I got in on the game, it's 2-0 Astros and Hunter Brown was just pulled pretty good, you know. And that's on the heels of a night where Spencer Arrighetti flirts with a no-hitter going into the eighth inning. Those are your two young guys back-to-back nights, you know, showing you something. Like, you got to feel good about that. And then, of course, you get that 2-0 lead because of your new addition. Your new / old addition, right?
Yeah.
Jason, 35-year-old Jason Hayward, who we all know has not been necessarily pristine for a long time. He's just been kind of a role player for some years now. It's been a long time since Jason Hayward was like a star, but he comes in and stars in his role immediately. The left-handed bat gets you that, you know, gets you that 2-run double to get you the lead, and yeah, man, it was pretty sweet night overall.
You know what? And Hayward immediately, I think it was in the first inning, he made a gutsy effort at a fly ball to right center field where you're watching, and like the cameraman, didn't even expect Jason Hayward to show up in the frame because you're watching, and Myers is kind of, you know, moving towards the ball, and all of a sudden he stops, and you're like, what the hell's going on? And Hayward comes out of nowhere like a missile from the side of the screen with a full speed running a 4.340 trying to catch the ball, and it actually hit his glove. He just didn't come up with it. It hit the palm of his hand and his glove. But, you know, they remind you that Kevin Eschenfelder reminded you that he was a five-time Gold Glover, and you're like, oh, okay, you got something here. All right, good, good. Yeah, I like lefties who are five-time Golden Glovers. And then at the end of the game, they bring in Dubon to swap out because he got a lefty pitcher, and then Dubon comes up big in the clutch. And that's a couple nights in a row now that Dubon has come up big in big moments. He made the play in center field to preserve the Arrighetti home runner, no hitter, and then last night comes up with a big hit.
Well, that's his role, Seth. That's what he is. That's what he's supposed to be. That it's the reason why I've always pushed back, or at least been reluctant, whenever it's been suggested for Dubon to be the everyday anything. Like, make Mauricio Dubon your everyday center fielder. Make him your everyday first baseman. Sure, I was frustrated as anybody when they weren't getting the performances you'd like to get from those particular positions, and I understand the value of Dubon and why you might want to insert him in there. But I'm like, man, the magic of him is that you can just throw him anywhere and you can put him out there in clutch situations, or in pinch hit situations as well, to come up big for you. I mean, he's a contact hitter, and so he's going to come up big for you more often than not. This was Joe Espada after the game on, and you heard us giving Joe Espada some credit for the strings he pulled last night. This was Joe Espada on the bench moves that he made.
And having pieces that you can go to and you trust, allow me to make those moves, and guys being prepared and embracing the you know, their roles, right? I'm be ready because I'm going to use you, and I'm not afraid to use anyone. You know, DeCenso playing third base there, he hasn't played an inning in the big leagues third base, and he makes a diving play. You know, Caratini stretches, and all that kind of stuff is good stuff, man. I'm so proud of these guys, you know, because they never quit.
Got it. Hey, look. One thing about Joe Espada, and I'll apologize for this if I ever participated, the whole idea that he's substitute teacher or he's just coming in to, you know, take over the reins of an already made roster and that he doesn't have to really put his imprint on the team and that he, like, that has just not rang true. This dude manages in his own style, in his own way. He's not a substitute teacher, and you got to give him a little credit, man.
I think, no, honestly, I could draw some similarities to the way when Caserio was brought in as the GM to a team, obviously, that wasn't nearly as good as the Astros were at their respective sport, but that it was a bigger mess than you even realize. Espada comes into an odd situation where it's been a really, really good situation, but way messier than you might think, given the success of the Astros with some of the dead weights around your ankle in terms of dead contracts and Abreu and everything else. You can put Dana Brown into the same category. There were challenges. There have been some challenges, and he just gets, I guess he's probably getting pretty good at it by now. Guy, usually when you're on a team where you're calling up guys that aren't quite ready for the majors, it's on a bad team, or it's guys that aren't even, you know, they're coming up because they're not your chosen ones. You're holding those guys down in the minors so that you can mess with their service time. It's just been so imperfect in so many ways. And I've heard so many Astros fans say that emotionally, this is one of their favorite teams from the past 9 years or 10 years of this run they've been on, because there's just so many underdog stories here.
Yeah, the thing that I appreciate the most about what Espada is doing is how he's been given limited options as far as depth in his bench, yet he's been unafraid to use it. You know, like, he's been unafraid to go to it, even though there are some suboptimal, less than ideal scenarios and options to go to. He has still tried to push the right buttons within the buttons that have been at his disposal.
Right.
And I can definitely respect that.
I mean, you come in. You use three pinch hitters in that game at the end. And it's, and the small ball, it's just becoming increasingly frequent and increasingly competent, I think. You know, and obviously you got to credit the players with that too. It's just, it's a breath of fresh air in a lot of ways for a team that, look, this team forever, like, it'd been various seasons, it was just the dominance of their lineup that almost, It made it dumb to use small ball at times, just because the chances of somebody at any given spot in the lineup could just hit a home run. And that's, statistically, analytically, everything else, like that was the smart, even though it hurts and it doesn't feel like it and it doesn't feel right, that was just the right thing to do. You're not in that situation anymore. And Espada just, he's getting a lot of practice for crunch playoff baseball potentially.
That's Seth Payne. I am Brandon Scott in for Sean Pendergast. Let's find out what NFL agents are saying about your Houston Texans. We'll see if we agree. That's next on Sports Radio 610.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be. To be.
Sometimes in football, you need just a little more for that first down. You need to be pushing the pile. And on our new podcast, we'll give you that extra effort.
I'm Mike Renner, a longtime NFL analyst who helped develop player evaluation systems that every NFL team uses to this day.
And I'm Kyle Long, former all-pro offensive lineman in the NFL who knows a thing or two about getting people moving.
You'll get expertise from inside the trenches and behind the tape for 4 episodes every week. So make sure you download and subscribe to the Pushing the Pile podcast on the Odyssey app.
Recovery from addiction can take many forms, and quite often, it's a team effort. For those in recovery, having support often leads to a better outcome. And for those supporting people in recovery, they celebrate every milestone. Here's to family, friends, loved ones, healthcare providers, and community groups who are essential to helping people find their path to recovery. If you or someone you know is experiencing addiction, visit cdc.gov/stopoverdose to learn more about the various treatment options available.
From the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking spokes puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare, the hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in store or at mybobs.com to play now.
Sports Radio 610 presents Payne and Pendergast.
Brandon Scott in for Sean Pendergast here with Seth Payne. And The Athletic talked to about 30 agents, looks like 31 agents, NFL agents that they talked to about the league, the state of the league, some NFL headlines, really more so about how organizations are run, more specifically, especially pertinent to what we're doing here. And we want to go through this a little bit because the Texans, and this is a credit to the organization, if you will, a credit to where they are now, because, look, Seth, you and I know, and we've been here for it, the narrative around the team and the organization has not always been as glamorous and as positive as it is today as we sit here. It was not that long ago when you had credible people saying that DeMeco Ryans shouldn't even consider trying to coach for the Texans, or that, you know, CJ Stroud, you know, worried about CJ Stroud's situation that he was inheriting by being drafted by the Texans. Like, is that even a place that you even want to go to? All right. Like, I'm old enough to remember that, Seth. That wasn't that long ago. And then now we've reached a point where The Athletic, a credible media organization, goes to 30 plus agents across the league to ask them what they think about how organizations are run. And we've got a few notes in here about the Texans and Nick Caserio, even specifically, having one of the better off seasons and being one of the better run franchises as of right now.
Yeah. It's Caserio comes off really well in this. I think the first and most notable thing, if we're don't play the celebration song. We don't want to overuse it, but this might be the first year where I've seen these surveys where the Texans aren't getting votes on the most unstable franchise or the front office you trust the least or stuff like that. They've always got at least one or two votes there. It's decreased over the last couple years, but because people were impressed with the hiring of D'Amico Ryans, but still very skeptical. And I think, remember going into last season, there were still people were like, well, they missed out on Bryce Young, of course, but C.J. Stroud might be all right. That was the first thing I looked for, was I scrolled down through all the graphs and everything. I'm like, look at all the negative ones. There's not a single Texans vote on here. I celebrate the perception of the Texans amongst anonymous agents, for whatever that's worth. So, the anonymous agent might be the sketchiest dude on earth.
Yeah, I'm sure they are. But I've always said, look, the credibility of a witness does matter. But a lying scoundrel can tell the truth. Like it depends on the situation, and you can decide to take what they say at face value. You don't have to believe it as gospel. Just take it in as information. And we do, stat nerd Seth, we do this. We take in useless information all the time just to make sure that we've got all the information and are able to decide whether it's useful or not. And I found this useful. I actually found this useful. Out of 31 responses from The Athletic to NFL agents, which GM or front office leader do you trust the most? Nick Caserio, he only got two votes, but that's the third. That's tied for the third most.
Yeah, like there are a lot.
He's right there in the mix with right there with Elliott Wolf and Brett Veach. You know, like that's not bad company to keep right there.
No, not at all. And it's like, again, with Caserio, a lot of it was, he got a couple votes. Most of these ones, when it came down to individual GMs, whatever, other than Roseman and somebody else who I'm blanking on, nobody got heavy, heavy votes. But Roseman obviously has been around for a long time and has done a really good job with the Eagles. But I think the quotes are the more impressive thing from some of these guys.
Here's one.
Yeah.
The Texans crushed the offseason after reaching the playoffs, and Caserio remains so underrated as a leader and thinker.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's...
As a leader and as a thinker.
And thinker. Like, to specify both, either or would have been nice. To specify both, I thought, was, pretty good. I don't know if that's an agent who Caserio's giving his client a favorable contract. Like, you can take all of this at face value and try to contextualize it. But I did think that was an interesting comment.
There were, Caserio himself has gotten some positive praise in this poll in the past couple years. If I recall correctly, specifically for the Deshaun Watson trade and managing his way through that scenario, I think agents looked at the way that he kind of took ego out of it, and he worked with it through a very contentious situation and ended up really with a deal that where both parties got a king's ransom. And a lot of people in the agent world, I think, were really impressed with the way the team and the owner worked together on that through what could have been, it could have been ugly, but yeah, and I think to go along with that too, which franchise had the best offseason?
Yes.
Commanders got the most votes with 8. Texans got the second most votes with 6.
Yeah.
And that was, the quote was from one of the agents, look what the Texans did in free agency. They kept Bobby Slowick. That helps C.J. Stroud, as does signing Joe Mixon and trading for Stephon Diggs. Nick Caserio might be the best and most underrated GM.
So this might come up again in the show, but one of the things that I learned from, and look, the Texans season premiere, at least from where we stood or from where we sat at the Odyssey table, Seth, was not what I considered like an on-the-record event. So, like, I'm not going to talk about like everything that was discussed there with players and different people there at the event. But a comfortable theme that I feel like I could share with you guys is Bobby Slowick is universally respected by the vets on that offense, right? Mm-hmm. Like the young guys have no choice, but the veterans who have been around, who have been coached by other credible offensive minds throughout the league, like guys that you would say are more credible and more accomplished than Bobby Slowick.
Yeah.
Guys like that respect Bobby Slowick and spoke specifically to Seth, the importance of Bobby Slowick returning, how they were surprised by it because they thought they were sure he was gone. They were surprised to have him back, and I would say pleasantly surprised, because they think it's really important for CJ, really important for the offense, and therefore really important for the team at large. So that little, that part right there about Bobby Slowick being retained, I think is an underrated part of the Texans offseason.
I like that agent, whomever it was, just because think about this. This isn't a – it's about the best offseason. And I'm guilty of this. Sometimes when I look at the free agencies that each team had, I'm like, oh, yeah, the Texans weren't as active as I thought they were. And then you remember, oh, no, it was the trading. They traded for Stephon Diggs. They traded for Joe Mixon. That a couple of the bigger, like the very most notable acquisitions were done by trade. So it was the offseason in the entirety. And, keeping Bobby Slowick, you count that as part of the offseason and what Caserio and Cal McNair, you know, with Cal McNair's approval, were able to pull off. I still wonder, and I've seen zero or heard nothing off the record or otherwise, but I just wonder, with the reports that the Falcons were very, very impressed with Bobby Slowick, I don't know if maybe they just, you know, cashed. I don't know what they did with Bobby. I don't know what the Texans did with Bobby Slowick's contract, but there's a chance that maybe they just went ahead and said, you know, like, hey, maybe these other situations might not be the best for you. And also, by the way, here's a really nice pay boost for you to come on back. And the ideally what you get is, if and when Bobby Slowick gets an opportunity as a head coach somewhere else, A, DeMeco's already got a roster full of potential OCs that he really likes, and that he, you know, that he's be able to get a guy that he already feels really comfortable with, maybe from in-house, but that B, that C.J. Stroud is basically an expert in this offense too.
Yes.
So it's a collaborative. You get to that point where your QB and your OC are collaborating on the football things to the point where it's not as big of a transition. And I think like C.J.'s well on his way. I think C.J.'s football mind has just blown people away. I think his ability to communicate with Bobby Slowick, those two just seem to be, they seem to have that perfect relationship where they're not afraid of offending each other. They can talk frankly about, like, hey, I think we need to be more aggressive downfield. Hey, no, we need to be able to do this differently. I feel very optimistic about that right now.
Yeah, and so that was another, I think, safe takeaway from last night's Texan season premiere at NRG Stadium. What you just said about DeMeco Ryans already having a roster of guys that could possibly be or of potential offensive coordinators to succeed,
yeah,
or to go behind Bobby Slowick if and when he moves on. And I would expect him to move on. I suspect he's going to move on after this season. I'd be surprised if he doesn't, just because of the energy and the momentum around it. And I don't feel like you want to risk it going the other way, the opposite direction. And I don't think it will. But you want to capitalize on this moment when your name is out there and it's hot the way it is. I did also get the sense, and this is, you know, based off of how they operated with play calling during the preseason, that they are actively looking for and believe that next man up is on their roster, on their coaching roster right now. Like
McDaniels.
Yeah, it could be McDaniels. Obviously, if Gerard Johnson sticks around and doesn't get, you know, an offensive coordinator job somewhere else, or, you know, an elevation somewhere else, a promotion somewhere else, he could be that guy. Gerard Johnson, Ben McDaniels. Obviously, Bill Lazor is somebody who's called plays before and would be like a safe option if for whatever reason they didn't feel comfortable going to another guy, you know, on the roster and couldn't get somebody, you know, specifically from outside that they really liked. I feel like that would be a safe option. But also to your point about CJ, whoever comes in or steps in for Bobby Slowick at that point, like especially after this year, Seth, I suspect if it goes the way I expect it to go, we'll be calling CJ Stroud's offense, right? Like it's the Coop Shanahan offense right now. But CJ Stroud's on his way, to your point about commanding the offense and elevating himself as far as like being that leader and that caliber of quarterback and taking ownership of the offense. You come in for year three of CJ Stroud, you're coming in to speak the language that he already speaks.
That's where, you know, CJ, in a weird way, I think gets he gets credit for a lot of the stuff he's done, partly because if you look at the Texans last year, there was no rushing attack. The receivers were unheralded at the beginning of the season. And there's just a perception, and I think rightfully so, that he did more with less compared to, like, Brock Purdy, where it's grudging and it's hard with Brock Purdy because he stepped into a situation where the offense was already in full gear. You've got all those studs out there on the field. So you don't know for sure exactly how it would have looked with Brock Purdy if he had lesser options. But with CJ, you got the benefit of seeing what he did with less. So anytime you heap more onto it, you already know, like, okay, he handled the mental side of things really well, and now he can just kind of keep building on it. And you're right, it's all these offenses, even though they're Coop Shanahan-y offenses, they get tweaked by their own respective coordinators and quarterbacks. And it just feels like with CJ, there's no limit on necessarily what you can or can't do with it. It feels like everything that you would want to do, he's able to incorporate it.
So one of the things I'm impressed by with CJ, since we're talking about the offense and Bobby Slowick, this is one thing that really impresses me. And we may have said this before in a different way, but the fact that CJ is in some ways greedy, and in some ways overly aggressive, overly ambitious at times, but also smart with it. Like, yeah, to be able to balance that aggression and that hunger and that desire to drive the ball downfield, maybe even sometimes at your own detriment, but to be wise and smart about it and to understand how it works within the offense, how it works within the matchups that you have. Like, to me, when you talk about his maturation, and we talked about that yesterday, that being kind of his superpower, him being, like, uncommonly mature,
yeah,
like, that is really impressive to me, to have that balance of aggression and swagger and want to challenge down the field, but also the wisdom to know when it's a good idea and why it's a good idea. Like, to have that at this age, to me, is wildly impressive.
And with some of the finer aspects of it, this is where watching the growth of CJ through last season was really fun to watch. Partly because Bobby Slowick, and this is another reason I think he's going to get a head coaching job, he's so good in press conferences. Like, honestly, I felt like if I didn't benefit from the Bobby Slowick press conferences on my YouTube channel as much as I do, I would almost recommend that the Texans not put those press conferences out on YouTube anymore, because Bobby's really, really good, and he sounds like a head coach in them. But there was one point where they talked about CJ, you know, holding safeties with his eyes, looking off, you know, maybe he's going to go to the right, but he's looking off to the left, all that kind of stuff, the nuanced stuff. And Bobby, at one point in the press conferences, talked last year, somebody, he was asked a question about that, and he said, yeah, you know, when we really, you know, early on, there was a point where CJ might have been doing it a little too much, because this is where the benefit of having coaches like D'Amico or Bobby Slowick, who started off on the defensive side of the ball, understand how smart defensive backs are, because sometimes a quarterback thinks he's being clever, but he becomes predictable and looking people off to the point where you can tell, like, oh, all right, he's in this certain situation, he's looking to the left, that means he's going to the right. And CJ took that lesson in and became more random with his look offs and how he tries to hold defensive backs and everything. And that's something that even really smart quarterbacks like Ryan Fitzpatrick, super smart, 50 on the Wonderlic, all that. There were times where being clever got him in trouble early in his career.
Yeah.
He'd get duped by defensive backs because they could tell what he was doing to try to dupe them, but it was way too predictable. And it's honestly a lack of intelligence and respect for the defense, which I get personally offended by. Offensive linemen do this too. Sometimes their line calls, like, they tell you exactly what they're doing, and you're like, what? Have you no respect for me, you fat bastard? Like, you're telling me exactly what the protection is. You haven't changed your calls in 2 years, you idiots.
Well, CJ Stroud definitely has enough respect for the defense to lie with his eyes. We've heard the Indianapolis Colts Colts linebackers, Zaire Franklin and EJ Speed, talk about that, right?
Yeah,
like exactly what
you were just saying. Yeah, you can't get predictable with it. You can't be at a 101 level with it. This is now, nobody does this anymore because there's so many guys are so mic'd up and it's easy to get the calls off of the TV copy. But when Gary Walker and I came here to the Texans, we were both on the Jaguars. We come to the Texans, and Gary Walker, great, great defensive tackle for those youngsters out there. But one of the things that Coughlin did, Coughlin was kind of like D'Amico. Coughlin wanted the ones to go against the ones as much as possible, including in during the regular season. Sometimes he wanted the ones to be scout team players. Like, he wanted the offensive linemen to get tested by the defensive line in practice way more so than a lot of other teams do it. So Gary and I had a lot of experience going against the Jaguars offense. We get into the first game, and these guys are using the exact same calls that they'd always used. And Gary and I were
thought y'all were a bunch of dumb jocks.
We're right there in your playbook, and we destroyed them. And I remember the center, John Wade, I talked to him about it after the season. John Wade came to the sideline. He's like, "Coach, they know our calls. They know our calls." And the O-line coach was like, "No, they don't know that. No, that's crazy." It's just a lack of respect for the intelligence of, okay, we're the dumbest position group on the field, the defensive line, but fine. Just have a little bit of respect for the opponent. I think with Bobby Slowick and D'Amico, you very much get the opposite. You get like, listen, these guys are smart as hell. At least some of them are. And you can't just go out there thinking you're going to dupe them with simple stuff.
Hey, Seth, the 832 was definitely listening to us yesterday. When was the last time Nick Caserio was in a fight? That and headlines next on Payne and Pendergast.
Headlines, right.
Payne and Pendergast with today's headlines.
Brandon Scott here for Sean Pendergast with Seth Payne. And before we get to headlines, I do want to address this question from the text line. From the 832 and 713-572-4610 is how you text the program. You can also get involved in our YouTube chat, Sports Radio 610 on YouTube and on Twitch. That is 610 Houston. When was the last time Nick Caserio was in a fight? That is in the spirit of the conversation we were having yesterday, Seth, about the last time you were in a fight and what age was it where you phased out of being willing to fight? What's the average age of, like, you know, non-fighting age, no longer willing to tolerate a squabble. So yeah. The 832 asks, when was the last time Nick Caserio was in a fight? I can't imagine it's been recent.
Break.
He was a quarterback, so I think that a lot of times, remember that was always the big question with Geno Smith was, there were always questions about his leadership. Holgorsen kind of even took a passive-aggressive shot at him after Geno Smith was gone from West Virginia about leadership. And,
well, and then, of course, he was socked in the face by a teammate early on
right.
in his career.
He got into some kind of a disagreement with that one teammate. You can't always fault the obvious. You don't want to blame the victim or anything, but most quarterbacks don't ever find themselves in a situation where things get heated enough that they get punched in the face. And I know that sounds like victim blaming, but they're just like that kind of personality. I think that Caserio probably has been in very few fist fights, if any, in his life, just because quarterbacks, there's just not a lot of quarterbacks that aren't like Chad Kelly or somebody else that you expect to get into fist fights.
Yeah, I'm not going to say that Nick Caserio ain't got no dog in him. I'm not going to say that, but I do feel like he would be better with conflict resolution, have a better idea for conflict resolution than having to come to fisticuffs.
His family was in the construction industry, so maybe Nick's like that.
Yeah,
that's a tough. It's hard to be out on job sites and not get into arguments and shouting matches at times. So I don't know.
When
Sean and I have him in next week, we'll ask him about what's his best story from working up in construction, you know, growing up and working construction.
I know you and Sean have a really good relationship with Nick Caserio. I've got a decent relationship with him.
Yeah.
I was tempted to make mob jokes, but like I'm not going to do that.
Oh yeah. No, I didn't even think of that. Well, I don't really think of.
Well, and they were going to be purely jokes just because, yeah. you know, Italian. Yeah, I mean, you know, simply jokes, but he and I have never had that kind of conversation or I don't know how comfortable he would be with that either, but to the point, like I don't think he's he's out here scrapping.
He doesn't seem like the type, right? Yeah, I think like D'Amico. Likewise, I can imagine D'Amico. Maybe he took a punch while being a peacemaker at something or some point. Like while he was trying to break up a fight, but I'd have a hard time seeing D'Amico getting into a lot of fights when he was young. Part of you know, there's two reasons you might not get into fights when you're younger. At least two. One is, okay, you're the coward of the county. Oh no. But two is that maybe you don't, if you're actually secure in yourself and you're mature, much more mature than many of us are as men, you don't take offense to things quite so easily. You're not worried about whether or not people are going to think you're soft. You just do what's right. And which is always the right thing, kids. Just at all expenses and costs, just doing the right thing usually entails not getting into a fight also.
Look,
matter what names people call you.
I mean this with all due respect, and Lord knows that I'm the last to want a stereotype, okay?
Yeah.
But I could see Caserio having a guy, you know?
Having a guy.
You know,
just like, a guy that does his dirty work?
Muscle.
Oh.
Having some muscle.
It's tough when you're that guy is Jack Easterby. Who's like, hey, I want you to go connive. Go connive for me, okay? All right, go give this guy the what for. What do you want me to do? You want me to create discord and disharmony behind his back? Okay.
Hilarious.
I think Easterby was an independent operator in a lot of ways, more so than a lot of people realized within the organization.
I could see that. I could definitely see that. That would actually even be. I feel like it's safe to say. I feel like that was my experience.
Consummate in business for himself guy, who's just really good at making it seem otherwise.
You know who could absolutely afford a guy if he wanted one or needed one? Like if he just needed somebody to handle business for him? Brandon Ayuk, because he finally got paid. That is one of the big headlines from yesterday. And I'm actually glad, Seth, that we didn't get into this because at the time, I thought that this was like that this standoff was reaching a breaking point, you know, with him out there finally actually cleared by the doctors and they were calling BS on him being injured or claiming injury, just going to the meetings, but not actually participating in practice. That was morning, you know, the show that we did yesterday. By the afternoon or by night, he'd gotten this deal, 4 years, $120 million. Kind of anticlimactic for me. Like I thought like it was going to be a lot more dramatic than this, that for sure they were going to have to end up trading him because he was just so damn principled that he was going to get more than $30 million a year or whatever the case was. But it turns out to be the 4 years, $120 million.
I think the biggest thing about this, there were two things about this negotiation that were interesting, is that this hold in that's become all the rage these days, where players aren't holding out, but they show up and they're not practicing with some mysterious injury or something. It sounded like the 49ers were ready to draw a hard line on that and say, cut the BS. You know, we know what's up and you're withholding services. We're not going to do what the Colts did last year with Jonathan Taylor, where they kind of just said, all right, okay, he's not available, but it is what it is. They weren't going to do that with Brandon Ayuk. So that part was interesting. The other part was that this was a good example of how the no trade clause is basically meaningless anymore, depending on who the player is, because players always have a no trade clause if they're willing to be disgruntled enough that if a team like the Patriots wants to trade for Brandon Ayuk, he doesn't have a no trade clause in his contract, but they're not going to trade for him and pay him that money if he doesn't want to go there. So he basically was able to block trades, and the Steelers potentially were a trade partner, but they would have had to work out a contract with Ayuk. It just, it had the potential to get really dicey and ugly, and now it'll be a relative afterthought.
Yeah,
going into the season.
Well, the point you make about the no trade clause is interesting because it made me think about how in a lot of ways, Deshaun Watson and David Mulugeta and Deshaun Watson by proxy sort of redefined the no trade clause. Like what it even means, actually.
He was the only, at the time Deshaun got a no trade clause, if I remember correctly, he was the only quarterback who hadn't won a Super Bowl who had a no trade clause. It was almost something that you would give. You might give to a guy if you felt really awesome about him, but there might have been one other exception in there. I think Garoppolo, because of it was a little bit more complicated. But I think now the players' leverage has swung over towards they're willing to be. If you're willing to be a big enough pain in the butt, then you've always got a no trade clause. You can shut down whichever trade you want just by being a pain in the butt.
Speaking of contracts and leverage. Dak Prescott says that there is no deadline to get a deal done. Obviously, he's on an expiring contract with the Cowboys. He says there's no deadline to get a deal done, but if it's not done by the time the season starts, then it says a lot. Let me ask you this, Seth. What does it say? And do you think the Cowboys are ready to move on from Dak? Would you?
I think it does say something. I think that look, basically the Cowboys financially, it makes sense that if they believe that Dak Prescott is their guy for the long term, it doesn't make any sense to kick the can down the road. It's just going to end up costing them more money the way it did the last time they did this very same thing. I think that Dak has been very diplomatic when discussing this. He usually says something to the effect of, I honestly just let my agent handle all this. I try not to worry about it. So this might be about the biggest or closest you get to a shot fired by Dak Prescott. And I think it's a statement of fact. It's that they probably are cool with moving on from him. Except that I'm not 100% sure of that, because Jerry Jones is so weird in these situations. He dragged his feet the first time and then still ended up paying Dak Prescott the big contract after Dak Prescott had a gruesome ankle injury. So I think I believe that that's Dak's reading on the situation, but I don't know if it actually means that they don't want to keep Dak Prescott long term.
Yeah, it's a weird thing, because like you mentioned, they did this already, and if you feel like they would have either learned or at the very least have a good sense for how they feel about Dak. And so it does say a lot that perhaps they are willing to go in a different direction, or at the very least they're undecided or they're waffling.
The one nice thing about all this, if you're watching the Cowboys drama, it's that Micah Parsons largely has not been a talking point about his contract extension or anything, and his agent is David Mulugeta. So for whatever that's worth, I feel like Mulugeta who has several players that he represents on the Texans by now. I don't fear the Mulugeta, everybody. Don't fear the Mulugeta. I think that Mulugeta is just like he's a very, very, very good agent, but it's not like he's impossible to deal with.
Other headlines that I want to mention before we get out. Colorado holds on to beat North Dakota State last night, 31-26, in some college football action. Also, North Carolina held on against Minnesota on a missed field goal at the end. And those are your headlines for the day. Coming up next here on Payne and Pendergast, Nick Caserio's draft classes. He's got four now with the Texans. I want to go through them and set expectations for this season with Seth Payne. We'll do that on Payne and Pendergast Sports Radio 610.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to LinkedIn.com/results to claim your credit. That's LinkedIn.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
Sometimes in football, you need just a little more for that first down. You need to be pushing the pile. And on our new podcast, we'll give you that extra effort.
I'm Mike Renner, a longtime NFL analyst who helped develop player evaluation systems that every NFL team uses to this day.
And I'm Kyle Long, former All-Pro offensive lineman in the NFL who knows a thing or two about getting people moving.
You'll get expertise from inside the trenches and behind the tape for four episodes every week. So make sure you download and subscribe to the Pushing the Pile podcast on the Odyssey app.
Trying to figure out what to eat for dinner yet again? With Norse sides and bouillon as your not-so-secret ingredient, you can skip the drive-thru and do dinner at home. Nor taste combos provide a menu of delicious, affordable, and well-balanced meals that you can prepare in 30 minutes or less. Visit nor.com to get quick and easy recipe ideas for your home-cooked weeknight dinners. It's not fast food, but it's so good.
In life, some days are good, and some could be better. The same is true for recovery. Both take work. Both take adjustments. Finding your path is a key part of your journey, and then it's all about walking it every day. Embrace the good days, the not so good days, and the challenges, and acknowledge how you overcame them. Be open to every part of the journey and welcome it. It's unique and it's all part of you. Find the path to recovery that works for you. Learn more at cdc.gov/stopoverdose.
From the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking Spunks puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare, the hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in store or at mybobs.com to play now.